about emotion when we talk about the Psalms, because the Psalms are full of the expression of emotion. We have to face it. Now, some of you love to talk about feelings. Some of you hate it. And there tends to be two camps when it comes to emotion and dealing with our emotions, right? We talk about the stuffers and the venters, right? There are the stuffers, who people who stuff their emotions in and maybe even deny that they have them, try to not let them influence their life and relationships and have no role. And then there are the others who will give full vent to emotion, and they just put it all out there, express it all, and they let emotion have the driver's seat in their lives, and often have to say they have to apologize for things they say because of that. Now, the Bible has a challenge for both of these types of people, because the Psalms don't fit with either of these. They teach us a middle way for expressing our emotions, to neither deny and stuff them, nor let them overtake us in ways that we lose control. The Psalms do give our emotions a place of importance in our prayer life, as if expressing our emotions is a necessary part of prayer. What they do is they teach us, here we go. They teach us to pray through our emotions in the presence of God. What we see in the Psalms is a reflective, intensive processing before God. You pour out your emotions in the process. Bring the whole mess to God. And that's a big part of biblical prayer. There are also two camps when it comes to theology and emotion. People think that you either study and know about God, or you feel and experience him. I had a friend once express real concern to me that my attending seminary classes and studying was going to dry up my soul. And I suppose it is true that there are some people who have grown cold while in seminary, but they're doing something wrong there. Because really, theology done right should stir our emotions. And the Psalms teach us that the reverse is also true, that emotion done right should stir our theology. The two are connected in a symbiotic way, where each one strengthens and intensifies or improves and illuminates the other. So there are a lot of Psalms we could look at that would show us this principle, but we're going to look at Psalm 3 today, partly because it's short and manageable. Some of them are not. So we're going to turn there, and Hannah's going to come up and read the psalm to us in its entirety while the rest of us turn there. Psalm 3.
Is it working? Oh, perfect. Psalm 3, a psalm of David when he fled from his son Absalom. Lord, how many are my foes? How many rise up against me? Many are saying of me, God will not deliver him. But you, Lord, are a shield around me, my glory, the one who lifts my head high. I call out to the Lord, and he answers me from his holy mountain. I lie down and sleep, and I wake again, because the Lord sustains me. I will not fear, though tens of thousands assail me on every side. Arise, Lord, deliver me, my God. Strike all my enemies on the jaw, break the teeth of the wicked. May the Lord from the Lord comes deliverance. May your blessings be on your people.
Thank you. Okay. Now let's look at it closely. At the top of Psalm 3 in my Bible, it says, morning prayer of trust in God. And that is a heading that was put there by the translator. But the next part that says, a psalm of David when he fled from Absalom, his son, that's the real deal. That's an original part of the psalm. And not all the psalms have this little introductory thing, but when they do have them, and especially if it gives you some of the context, it's worth looking that up, that episode from David's life, and seeing what's going on. So If you want to read it in its entirety sometime, it's found in 2 Samuel chapters 15 through 19. And what's going on there is David's son, Absalom, has risen up against him. He's trying to take the throne. And this was actually not uncommon in the ancient world. But the thing is, if you're going to try to overthrow the king and take the throne from him, you have to kill the king. And so David flees. And we're told that 12,000 foot soldiers are chasing after him. So when we read these first two verses, and David says, "O Lord, how my adversaries have increased. Many are rising up against me. Many are saying of my soul, there is no deliverance for him in God." We know he's not exaggerating. Things are really bad for David. David's calling out to God because he's afraid, and he has good reason to be. The first thing he does, sorry, I'm going to give you the verses there. Those are the first two. The first thing he does is bring his fear before God, identifies his source, the source of his fear. There in verse 1, it tells us the source of his fear are adversaries. There is an outward physical threat that causes his fear. But there is another layer to his fear, right? The first layer, 12,000 foot soldiers. But what is it in verse 2? It's words. People are saying things, that God's not there for David, that God's done saving David. David was chosen as king by God, but word on the street is God's done with David. This is an attack on his identity, and David is listening to them. So remember David's story. Samuel the prophet came to Jesse and said, "One of your sons has been chosen by God to be a great king." And he goes through all the sons of Jesse, rejecting each one. And then God chooses David. And he becomes a great king, just because of God's grace and goodwill. And for the first half of his life, David is golden boy, right? Everything is going right for him. He is God's man. And then something happens. He starts to see his gifts from God as something to be used to get what he wants, and most notably, Bathsheba. And after that, his family, his kingdom, his life starts falling apart. His son staging a coup against him is one indication of that. So people are saying, God's done with David. Not his chosen one anymore. David's identity is being threatened and called into question here. So the fear caused by this, we are going to distinguish from the fear of verse 1 by identifying it as anxiety. It's a threat from within, because he's listening to the messages that cast doubt on God's faithfulness and on David's identity and relationship to God. So start thinking about these questions as we go through the rest of this. Who are your adversaries? And what messages cause you anxiety? Because that's going to be where your application comes. Things are bad for David. Life is spiraling out of control. But does he get emotional about it? Yes, of course he does. This is David. We know David. He's an emotional guy. He does get emotional. He starts his prayer with, "There are so many adversaries. They're all around me. I'm freaking out, God." Right? He does get emotional. But he also gets theological. There is a shift coming. So picture yourself in a situation that is suddenly out of control. It could be a lot of things, but let's say a water pipe has burst in my house and there's water everywhere. And I feel like I have to act quickly, but I don't really know what to do. So I'm just running around like a chicken with his head cut off, reacting emotionally. And then I call over my neighbor who knows something more about plumbing than I do. And he comes in and he says, "Well, let's just think about this for a minute." And I stop and I think, why didn't I think of thinking about it for a minute? Right? So as we move into verse 3, we see David stopping to think about it for a minute. I lost my slide. He gets theological, and this is what calms the storm in his heart. He, first of all, he establishes what he knows about God. And in verse 3, he says, "But you, O Lord," hold on, there you go, But you, O Lord, are a shield about me, my glory and the one who lifts my head. We're given three images here. This is poetry. So it's full of metaphor. We have to read it really slowly and ask ourselves, why did David choose these metaphors to describe God in this situation? The first one is a shield. So we think of shield, protection, right? So we think protection and we think God is going to protect me and take me out of this bad situation. But let's think about a shield for a minute. You wake up in the morning and you strap on a shield, what's your assumption about the day? That shield is going to prevent bad things coming at you? No, you put on a shield because you assume bad things are going to come at you. You don't need a shield in peacetime. You need it when you're in the middle of a battle and a struggle. God protects his people, not always from the circumstance, but always in the circumstance. He may not remove you from the difficulty, but he will shield you in the midst of it. We tend to think when something bad or tragic happens to us that God has abandoned us. But that comes from an assumption that it's God's job to keep bad things from happening to us so that we're always comfortable and happy. But that's not the promise. The promise is that when life in this broken world gets bad, which it will, God's going to be right there with us. In fact, in times of tragedy, we may experience God closer than we ever have before. The God of the Bible sometimes rescues his people out of difficulty, but sometimes he doesn't. Sometimes that difficulty is the tool he uses to draw us close to him as we cling to him as our shield. The second metaphor we get here is glory. Now, when we hear shield, protection comes to mind. When we hear glory, it's possible nothing comes to mind. Because we don't really use this word regularly outside of a church context. So let's look at the word glory and try to see what was coming to the author's mind, to David's mind. The word David uses is kavod. And this Hebrew word for glory also means weight, significance, importance. So to give God glory is to declare that he is the most significant, most important thing in the world. But humans can have glory too. In 1 Chronicles 29, it's talking about David at the end of his life, and it says, David died full of days, wealth, and glory. That's a bit of a spoiler because now you know he recovers from this Absalom situation. David's kavod, David's glory, came from his rags-to-riches story, right? From his kingship. But now he doesn't have that. He doesn't have any of the things that gave him glory before. He was a great king, but not anymore. The father, the head of this great dynastic family, well, the family's falling apart. Well, can he say, oh, at least I have my moral integrity? He can't even really cling to that. And now he's telling God that God is his kavod, his glory, his significance, his importance. Why is it important he say this? Well, because up until now, something else has been his glory. He tried being his own glory, and it flopped. Right? He misplaced his glory, and now his anxiety and fear are making him realize this. Rock bottom is helping David see and acknowledge that his only glory is in God. The third metaphor is the head lifter, right? The one who lifts my head. And this is related to glory. It has to do with confidence and dignity. It's the same as in English. We talk about holding your head high. In David's culture, to lift someone else's head was a public sign of dignity and honor. If the king lifts your head, that's a really big deal because it's showing everyone that you are accepted and honored by the king. But now David, the king, is telling God that he is the one who lifts his head. David is saying, I have no reason to lift my head, no reason to be confident in myself anymore, except God. God's the only reason I have to be confident. He is the one who lifts my head and gives me dignity. Even though everyone else is saying I'm an utter failure, God lifts my head in front of everyone and gives me reason to hold it high. And then after getting emotional and getting theological, hold on, David acts on his theology. In verses 4 and 5, it says, I was crying to the Lord with my voice, and he answered me from his holy mountain. I lay down and slept. I awoke, for the Lord sustains me. Now you might notice that my version looks different than the one up there. And that's because we get some different translations. I'm learning that tense is tricky in Hebrew, and clarity of tense didn't seem to be as important to Hebrew speakers as it is to English speakers. So this could be like mine says, I was crying to the Lord and he answered me. But it is probably more likely like this, what's up on the screen. It could be, I cry out to the Lord and he answers me. I lay down and sleep. Or it could be a conditional kind of thing. When I cry out to the Lord, he answers me. But because David knows these things about God, he prays. He calls out to God. He knows God hears and answers. So why does he say, from his holy mountain? Why is that important? What's there on the holy mountain? Well, the holy mountain is where the temple is, the tabernacle in David's time, they called it. Why does the tabernacle give him confidence? What happens in the tabernacle? That's where the sacrifice happens. The sacrifice that covers sin and failure. And that's why David, sinner and failure that he is, can call out to God and know that he hears and answers because of that sacrifice that covers sin. Now for us, on this side of the cross, what is it we look to? What mountain? What sacrifice? We look to Calvary, right? We look to Jesus, the sacrifice that took our sins. And so we have confidence, though we're sinners and failures, that God hears and answers us. And then he sleeps, the second thing he does. He sleeps. In this confidence, he trusts, because he knows God hears and answers and protects. He's got enemies all around him, but he leaves it in God's hands and rests, trusting in God's care. And then finally, in verse 6, David's theology affects his emotions. And he writes, I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people who have set themselves against me round about. There is no need to be afraid. This is why he can sleep. He's let go of his fear into the hands of God. And then in 7 and 8, we get his request. Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God, for you have smitten all my enemies on the cheek. You have shattered the teeth of the wicked. Salvation belongs to the Lord. Your blessing be upon your people. You might notice again that mine was different than what's up there. It could be that it's like the way mine is written, that he is declaring his confidence in God by declaring the victory as if it's as good as done. This was a thing they would do. Talk about something that you're confident in as if it's already happened because it's as good as done. It could be this, that he is calling on God to strike my enemies, shatter the teeth. Again, tense is tricky. But either way, he's releasing it from his own hands, putting it in God's hands. It's God who strikes the winning blow. God is our source of victory. And then do you see the turnaround from verse 8 and 2? In verse 2, the people were saying, there is no deliverance for him in God. There's no salvation in him in God. And then in 8, David is declaring, salvation comes from the Lord. Deliverance and salvation, it's actually the same word in Hebrew. I don't know why my Bible uses two different ones, but he's wrapping it up. This is what people are saying, that God's not going to save. He ends it by saying, yeah, salvation comes from God. Before we go on, do we need to talk about how David is calling on his enemies calling on God to strike his enemies and hurt them. Maybe we're shocked by his desire for violence. Mark is actually going to go into this in more detail next week. He's going to do like a more severe imprecatory psalm and help us know what to do with those. But I want to say two things about this without stealing his thunder. The first thing is, we know these are real emotions that people have. This desire to see the people who are hurt, who have hurt you, hurt themselves. That's a real thing. Right or wrong, that's an emotion people have. And David's doing the right thing here by bringing it to God. He's not acting on it. In fact, David didn't lift a finger against Absalom, tried to protect him. But he's bringing these emotions to God, venting and processing them before God and handing them over to him. That's the right thing to do with those kind of emotions. But also, these are poetic images also. They're trying to tell us something. Striking someone on the cheek was a sign of public humiliation and disgrace in David's culture. It's kind of the opposite message from lifting someone's head. David's asking God to show everyone that that God approves of David, not of this other person who's trying to take the throne. And then the breaking the teeth is a picture of an enemy losing his power to hurt. Oftentimes, wicked enemies are described as a ravenous lion or some other predatory animal coming after you with his teeth. And so breaking the teeth is disarming that enemy so he doesn't have the power to hurt. So these images are David requesting that God show people that he's on David's side and not his enemy's side, and asking God to disarm his enemies so they don't have the power to hurt him anymore. For us today, who are our adversaries? Who are we praying this kind of thing against? People? Well, Ephesians tells us that our battle is not against flesh and blood, not against people, but against spiritual forces, where those messages that creep into our hearts and minds come from. Our prayer may be that God take the teeth off these messages of darkness that we listen to. And it may be that we're the ones who need to see God's display of approval on us. So we read this psalm twice. They're meant to be read over and over again. I'm going to encourage you to do that this week and think about what would it look like for you to take this same journey. David took a journey in this prayer, pouring out his emotions, getting theological, acting on his theology, and then letting his theology affect his emotions. We can ask ourselves, is there a very real physical source of fear in our life? You should identify it, bring it to God, turn it over to him, and let him be our shield. Or is it anxiety that's rising up against you? Bring that to God. Sort it out with him in his presence. Identify the message it is that you're paying attention to. And then we should ask ourselves, could it be a case of misplaced glory? Are we finding our status and significance in the wrong place? We tend to try to find it in all sorts of silly places. But look at your anxiety as an opportunity to identify the source and replace your glory with God's and have your head lifted. Again, read this psalm over and over. In fact, read many psalms this week. You'll find that they're full of emotion and theology. That's the bulk of them. There's very little requesting in comparison. It's a lot of emotion and theology in these prayers. Let's learn how to pray this way ourselves. Let's pray. God, teach us how to pray. Help us get comfortable bringing our emotions to you, and then teach us how to stop and get theological. May we be people whose theology stirs our emotions, and whose emotions stir our theology. Teach us to calm the storms in our hearts by reflecting on who you are and what we know to be true. You are good. You are wise. and you are powerful. Thank you that you are trustworthy, and you invite us to bring our everything to you and put it before you. Thank you for the invitation to know you and to talk to you, and thank you for loving us.